Blog Talk Radio. Well, I don't know if it's the end of the world. I kind of doubt it. In the meantime, I've got to report to you on this 10th day of August that even other atheists don't trust atheists. And this is from the Daily Mail. Do we need religion to have good morals? Even atheists think horrific crimes are likely committed by atheists. All of the evil that is done in the name of government seems to have been, come out of in the last century to have been generally fostered by atheists. Now I know Frankie is probably going haywire right now, looking to double down on his baby bottle full of scotch. But the fact of the matter is that researchers have found that there's a prejudice against atheists existing in 13 countries. And in addition to the fact that religiosity or Christianity in particular has dropped in many countries. And so there is a link in people's minds between religion and morality. And the study shows that even though religiosity or church going commitment to the Bible has dropped, people still connect the morality of doing good and being conscientious to religion. Now, people are twice as likely to view extreme immorality as representative of atheists than of believers. And this is at the University of Kentucky, where they did the research. And it was published in the journal called Nature. And I've been waiting to do this article for you guys. August 7th is when it came out. So this is an article that was just in a study that was just published. And Professor Gervais, who did the research and published it, says, "The variability across countries does to me suggest that this prejudice against atheism could change in the future as effects were smaller in the most secular countries. To the extent that religiosity declines, entrenched pro-religious and anti-atheistic cultural norms may erode, eventually bringing intuitive distrust of atheists with it." In other words, as people become less Christian and less religious, they will less likely connect doing good with religion. But for the time being, that's how it is. Case Western Reserve University, Ohio, was also involved in this. Also, it was pointed out that religion can foster evil doing, such as the radical jihadists. But what do you think about that? Do you consider religion to be important for people having guidance, doing well? So what would be the connection between that? Number one, that you have a set of rules in religion that you don't in others. In the Jewish and Christian, you have the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount. In the Muslim, you have the teachings of Muhammad. In Buddhism, you have the Eightfold Path and other suggestions for being good, doing the right thing. Hinduism is more primitive than Buddhism, but similar ideas. Now, the study was based on more than 900 people, and it did find similarities between strongly religious and non-religious people. In both groups, the most dogmatic or fixated on their beliefs people are less good at analytical thinking and also less likely to look at issues from other people's perspectives. That's interesting. 209 participants identified as Christian, 153 as non-religious, 9 Jewish, 5 Buddhist, 4 Hindu, 1 Muslim, and 24 of other religions, and they tested them on dogmatism or fixation on belief, empathy or identifying with other people's suffering and concerns, and also analytical reasoning. They showed that religious participants as a whole had a higher level of dogmatism. Well, I just pointed that out. So what do you think about that? Now, what happened in these countries where things went haywire? Soviet Union, Communist China, and I had mentioned before Dostoevsky, the great writer, who was very focused on morality and politics. And I believe Dostoevsky, he was living in Russia before Marxism really got off the ground there. His take on it was that when you have a political system that comes in and takes over for religion, it's not a good outcome. And when he went to prison, he was put into prison for being involved in a socialist group. He was actually sentenced to death, and they did a mock execution of him and his friends. The Tsar commuted his sentence, but when he went into religion, he went in there thinking that people had to have religion. The poor had to have religion to have direction in their lives. As he left prison 4 years later, he had concluded that religion was important for everybody on a personal level, as well as you know, as well as having direction. It's important to have something positive to live for. And, you know, if you really get into Marxism, and somebody had called up and said, you know, Marxism isn't just a national, international problem, it's a local problem, which I agree with 100%. You have people, for example, with the bus system, the transit system here, refusing to listen to the voters, demanding to bring in the bus system, seeing that it's not just a mild failure, but an absolute, total, unmitigated disaster, and they're not embarrassed at all, and they do everything they can to keep it, because they're in a philosophical system that doesn't have any, well, as this study suggested, doesn't have any, give people analytical ability, doesn't allow them to think for themselves. They pick up a set of principles and they stick with them. And that's why you have to say a Marxist is as bad as any fundamentalist. Now, the New York Times wrote about this as well. And one of the things that they pointed out was a question error that had a description of a sociopath, a man who is having tortured animals when he was young, later began hurting people and has killed five homeless people that he abducted from poor neighborhoods in his home city. He's a professor, but he's still doing that. I think that's how it went. And their dismembered bodies are currently buried in his basement. A question followed. Half of the participants in each country got one version of the question. What's more probable, the man is a teacher? Or two, the man is a teacher and does not believe in any gods. And the other half got another version. What's more probable, the man is a teacher, or the man is a teacher and a religious believer? As it settled out, as it filtered out, it was said to be more likely that in the one group that the man was a teacher and an atheist, and least likely that the man was a teacher and a religious person. So anyway, there's a sense that religion is needed to guide people. So when you don't have that, what do you end up with? And I think you end up with in a situation with people who don't really have any. They have principles, they have ideas, but they don't really have any direction. They don't have any. They don't have any firm conviction. So we are taught in this culture that if you don't believe in God, it's likely you're smarter. You're more of a free thinker. You're more likely to be a scientist, a person who sticks to facts. And to be an individual who is basically, you know, is not sentimental or emotional. And so I found this little clip from Chris Langan, the man with an 200 IQ. I stumbled across this. This is from four years ago. The man with an IQ of 200, he might be the smartest guy in the world. I thought it was kind of interesting. Let's take a break, and I'm going to come back and play that for you because I want to be caught up on my ads. And yes, we will get into blowing people up with nuclear weapons here in a second. But first, a little bit from Glenn Campbell. And so another one of his beautiful live songs. This is a great song. If you've ever had a chance to hear it, it's written by this guy. I'm trying to remember his name, Johnny something or other. He was Hartford. And really just a phenomenal song itself. But here's one of the great guitar players in the history of America, Glenn Campbell, who just passed away.
On my mind. It's knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk. That makes me tend to leave my sleeping bag rolled up and stashed behind your couch. And it's knowing I'm not shackled by forgotten words and bonds and the ink stains that are dried upon some line. That keeps you in the back road by the rivers of my memory. It keeps you ever gentle on my mind. Thank you.
All right, so this guy's name is Chris Langan, and he is currently a farmer, I think in Missouri, but here we go. Chris Langan, the man with a 200 IQ, on his thoughts on God. Hold on just a second here. All right, hold on. My machine just froze up a little bit. And as you know, the show is ending. The format is ending in the September 1st. It goes to Mexican radio or Spanish language music.
We headed to the far reaches of Missouri, a five-hour drive passing small towns and farm fields down a roller coaster of a country highway because we wanted to find this man.
Mojo. My boy.
Chris Langan and his wife, Jeannie, have about 130 acres here.
I think it's about 20 horses, two llamas, two cows.
Along with assorted barn cats and dogs. So what's so special about this low-key guy living a low-key life? We'll go inside his house. See that chalkboard? See the board in the living room? Can you figure out what any of that means? We couldn't either. That's not doodling.
This particular paper is on something called a conspansive manifold.
That's the work of a guy with an estimated IQ of about 200. Most of us have an IQ of 100, score in the 140 range, and you're in the genius to near genius category. 195 to 200, well, you're talking one in several billion people. Now, historians figure that Einstein and Franklin scored about 160, Darwin, 165, Galileo, 185, Isaac Newton, 190. That means Langan could possibly be the smartest person in the world. When he's not working with the animals, he's busy with his CTMU, the Cognitive Theoretic Model of the Universe.
It's a theory that studies the relationship between mind and reality. In other words, what's out there in the real world, how does the mind relate to it?
And Langan is trying to prove nothing less than the existence of God.
Is there heaven?
Yes.
How do we know that?
You don't.
Do you believe or you don't?
It's not that simple. I happen to know there's a heaven because I know that you can use your will to create things. In other words, do you continue to exist after you die? Absolutely. Nothing in this universe is wasted. Nothing ever ceases to exist, really. The essence always remains preserved.
So who is this guy, and why haven't you heard of him? He began speaking at 6 months old, reading at three, born in California, but constantly being uprooted.
We didn't have a lot of money, and the old man was always in need of a job, so he had to go where the work was.
He was poor, skipped a few grades. Teachers urged his classmates to be like Chris. So how did they respond? Well, they beat him up.
As a matter of fact, I had to fight my way through high school.
So at 12, he got into bodybuilding. He tried college, but never finished. It was costly, and, well, he was smarter than the teachers.
There's the fool, and there's Star, his mother.
So is Langan out here in what some consider the middle of nowhere, squandering a precious gift?
I mean, why am I not a famous politician or financier? Filthy rich, simply because those things don't mean that much to me. I'd rather have some meaning in my life, and this is how I get it.
So how has he made a living?
In construction, farmhand, ranch hand, cowboy, firefighter. I worked for the Forest Service for about 4 years. Just anything I could get my hands on.
He even started his own rock band. He skipped an audition in L.A. and went to New York instead, where for years he worked as a bouncer in a bar. He met Jeannie online through a high IQ group. She was born and raised in Brooklyn, played for the American...
Anyway, I thought it was kind of interesting that this guy who's supposedly the smartest in the world is is not only religious, but is trying to prove the existence of God. But there is this other guy that I'd read about quite a while ago, James William J. Sidis, who supposedly had an IQ of 300 and went to Harvard University and ended up being kind of a nutball. And he was a socialist. So he ended up being a socialist and having a complete disaster of a life. He tried to get a law degree at Harvard after graduating from Harvard, I think. And so he withdrew from the program, being smart enough to realize the pitfalls of law, and struggled with his self-identity. He was arrested for being a ringleader of an anti-draft communist-leaning demonstration, put in jail, and that's where he would meet the only woman he would ever love, an Irish socialist named Martha Foley. And so anyway, I guess you can't tie everything into IQ, or maybe anything, but just thought I'd get your reaction from that. All right, let's get some local news, and we're going to jump into Pyongyang, into what's going on in Guam, and a little bit. I'm going to give you a little insight into what a nuclear war would be like. Make sure you use plenty of sunscreen. We'll be right back. 629 Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523 1450. I converted the text machine into my private phone when I lost one phone and broke another, but probably by the time I get it all straightened out, I'll be off the air. But you're listening to Death Row Radio. We'll be right back. It's gone. It's dead on September 20, number one.
Though the wheat fields and the clotheslines and the junkyards and the highways come between us, and some other woman's crying to her mother 'cause she turned and I was gone, I still might run in silence, tears of joy might stain my face, and a summer sun might burn me till I'm blind. But not to where I cannot see you walking on the back road by the rivers flowing gentle on my mind.
All right, there's some worry about Donald Trump, fire and rain, or fire and fury. Here's from the San Francisco Gate. Can Donald Trump be trusted with these nuclear codes, the nuclear football? Will he try to punt? Check it out.
President Trump has followed up his fire and fury warning to North Korea with a brag on Twitter about the United States nuclear arsenal. Trump's tweets come after Pyongyang said it was considering plans for a missile strike on the U.S. Pacific territory of Guam.
I think Americans should sleep well at night. I have no concerns about this particular rhetoric of the last few days. I think the president, again, as commander-in-chief, I think he felt it necessary to issue a very strong statement directly to North Korea. But I think what the president was just reaffirming is the United States has the capability to fully defend itself from any attack and defend our allies, and we will do so.
Guam is home to about 163,000 people and a U.S. military base. The two B-1B bombers that flew over the Korean Peninsula in a recent show of force had taken off from Guam.
All right, so this is old news, but anybody who knows anything about the military capabilities realizes that one of our nuclear subs, just one, could wipe out that entire country. I know it seems astounding to hear that, but that's the fact. I mean, there's so much power in thermonuclear warheads, hydrogen bombs, if you will. Now, here is the question: how strong is America's nuclear arsenal?
With fire and fury, like the world has never seen.
I do not believe that there is any imminent threat, in my own view. The president was doing is sending a strong message to North Korea in language that Kim Jong-un would understand, because he doesn't seem to understand diplomatic language. So the American people should sleep well at night.
These are the trying times. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, we stood behind JFK. This is analogous to the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Messages out of the Trump administration today. The State Department saying it's all one voice about the North Korean issue. Defense Secretary Mattis putting out a statement today. The United States and our allies have the demonstrated capabilities and unquestionable commitment to defend ourselves from an attack. The DPRK, North Korea, should cease any consideration of actions that would lead to the end of its regime and the destruction of its people. While our State Department is making every effort to resolve this global threat through diplomatic means, it must be noted that the combined Allied militaries now possess the most precise, rehearsed, and robust defensive and offensive capabilities on Earth. The DPRK's regime's actions will continue to be grossly overmatched by ours and would lose any arms race or conflict it initiates. The only time we heard from the president today was through Twitter, where he tweeted, "My first order as president was to renovate and modernize our nuclear arsenal. It is now far stronger and more powerful than ever before. Hopefully, we will never have to use this power, but there will never be a time that we are not the most powerful nation in the world." With that, we'll bring in our panel. Eli Lake, columnist for Bloomberg View, Charles Lane, opinion writer for The Washington Post, and Bill Bennett, former education secretary and host of the Bill Bennett Show podcast. Thanks for being here. Eli, let me start with you. Is it a mixed message? It seems like Secretary Tillerson is trying to dial back the tone, the rhetoric, but the defense secretary kind of shoring up what the president had said.
I think it goes hand in hand. What Secretary Tillerson is doing is he's opening a door. He's saying regime change is not our policy. We want to try to resolve this. But I think that having the threat very articulated by the president and later by Mattis, and I think Mattis was more precise in his words because he didn't talk about threats. We're always going to get threats from North Korea. He spoke about their actions. We will if we must. I think that that's probably the best message at this point to send. And most people believe Kim Jong-un is a rational actor. He wants to preserve his regimes. That's why he's pursuing this capability to hit us.
Chuck.
Well, I kind of agree with Eli. I think there's, discernible, at least potential strategy, kind of good cop, bad cop routine. If you want to talk to Rex, he's available. But if you don't want to talk to Rex, you deal with Jim Mattis. Having said that, I think a lot of people were a little taken aback at the precise language that the president used, in part because it was so aggressive. I mean, there have been a lot of stories comparing it to past statements by presidents about, what would await North Korea if they got involved in a war with the United States. And this was over the top with respect to those. And people, I think, are a little concerned, like the president's never been through one of these before. And does he really know how to modulate?
Blah, blah, blah. Okay, so if Trump is good at one thing, it's knowing how to read people emotional and get their goat. So maybe he got this North Korean goat, little Kim. Take a break here. The Hurricane Franklin, Franklin came up, passed over the Yucatan Peninsula, that little spur that sticks out on the right side of the bottom of Mexico, passes over it, gets into this warm water, turns into a hurricane, and then moves on shore and is now a tropical storm or tropical depression. So not real powerful, but I think we should see the clouds and the storms from that. Take a little break here for your local news, local weather. 523-1450 Kelly O'Connell, Death Row Radio. It's dying on September 1st and will be born anew as Mexican radio.
I dip my cup of soup back from a gurgling, crackling cauldron in some train yard. My beard a roughening coal pile and a dirty hat full low across my face.
All right, so here is CNN broadcasting from a Hawaiian bunker. Talk about a little bit of overkill, huh?
Not the only island within striking distance of North Korea.
Another potential target within Kim Jong-un's range is Hawaii, which is where Sarah Seidner is live tonight. She's inside a bunker in Honolulu, which houses the Emergency Operating Center's state warning point. Of course, Sarah, if North Korea launched a nuclear warhead toward Hawaii, let's just start with the very basics here. If such a thing were to occur, how long would it take to go from launch to strike?
Just 20 minutes, Aaron. That is what all the experts say. They say that from the time of launch from North Korea with a nuclear warhead, it could land in Hawaii in 20 minutes, which means there will be about 5 minutes as it's being tracked, and then there will be 15 minutes to get the population warned. And here's where that warning would come. First, there would be a call that would come into this phone. It's a secure line. This gentleman would pick up the phone. He would say, okay, the missile is coming. And then there would be a warning that would go out to the entire population. They have sirens that they are working on now to make sure that the population knows exactly what that sound means, that there's an attack that's going to happen. This phone would be picked up by someone sitting here. They would pick up the HWAS phone and they would call all of the counties, and that goes to all the counties directly to let them know that a warning siren is necessary and that an attack is underway. Aaron?
So Sarah, I mean, it's pretty stunning when you talk about 20 minutes, of which really only 15 minutes count to warning people. How is Hawaii actually preparing for the potential of a nuclear strike? It's one thing to have such an idea and concept, and it's another perhaps to look at it as a real risk.
Absolutely. It's a really good question. How do you prepare when you only have, for example, 15 minutes? But that is why Hawaii is looking for, they are the first state to try and get their population prepared. They've been working on this for months now, at least 7 months, trying to come up with a really good plan and get that plan out to the public. And what they're telling people is, look, you need to look at your surroundings because, and this is really important, a lot of people on this island believe that if they're hit with a nuclear warhead, that everyone is going to die. And the emergency management folks here say that is absolutely not true. Not true. There will be lots of survivors. And your ability to survive will probably depend on where you are and what you have planned for. So if you're in a car, you want to get inside of a building. If you're in your house, you want to get to the center of the house. If you're on the beach, see if there's a cave nearby or go across the street to a building. Try to get below ground if you can. These are all things that they're trying to get out to the public. And this is a just-in-case scenario. People here are not panicking. The emergency management folks do not want people to panic, but they want them to be prepared. Preparation is everything.
All right. Okay, so having said that, I've got another clip here for you. What if we have a nuclear war? This is what would happen, and this is from January 26, 2017.
Bombs dropped over Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Let me go right back to the very beginning of this so we don't miss anything.
70 years ago, the nuclear bombs dropped over Hiroshima and Nagasaki exploded, and to this day remain the only use of nuclear weapons for warfare. But with around 15,000 warheads remaining in the world, what happens if we have a nuclear war? The impact of a single nuclear bomb depends on many factors like the weather, weapon design, geographical layout of where the bomb hits, and if it explodes in the air or on the ground. Approximately 35% of the energy comes in the form of thermal radiation or heat. Since thermal radiation travels at approximately the speed of light, the flash of light and the heat come several seconds before the blast wave, and this causes flash blindness to anyone looking, a temporary blindness of a few minutes. With a 1 megaton bomb, which is 80 times larger than the Hiroshima bomb, but much smaller than many modern nuclear weapons, those 21 kilometers away would experience flash blindness on a clear day, and even up to 85 kilometers away on a clear night. Thermal radiation burns happen closer to the bomb, with first-degree burns occurring around 11 kilometers, second-degree burns at 10 kilometers, and third-degree burns destroying skin tissue at 8 kilometers. Third-degree burns that cover over 24% of the body will likely be fatal without quick medical care. These distances are variable depending on the weather and what clothing you're wearing. White clothing, for example, can reflect some of the energy, while darker clothes absorb it. At its center, the Hiroshima explosion was estimated to be 300,000 degrees Celsius, which is over 300 times hotter than the temperature bodies are cremated at. This intense heat reduces a body to its basic elements. The radiation from the blast also behaves like sunlight, so objects cast shadows where the radiation doesn't directly hit. But most of the energy released in a nuclear explosion is in the blast, which drives air away from the site of the explosion, creating a sudden change in air pressure that can crush objects or knock them down. If we use a 1 megaton bomb as an example again, within a 6 kilometer radius, there would be an estimated 180 tons of force on the wall of every two-story building with wind speeds of 255 kilometers an hour. Within a 1 kilometer radius, the peak pressure is 4 times greater and wind speeds reach 756 kilometers an hour. The human body can endure this amount of pressure. However, the winds would create fatal collisions with nearby objects, so deaths would largely be from collapsed buildings. All this at 1 megaton. Compare that with the largest nuclear bomb ever detonated, the 50 megaton Tsar Bomba dropped on an isolated island in Russia, and you're looking at 3,333 Hiroshima bombs combined. If you happen to survive all this, now you have to worry about radiation. Now, not all radiation is harmful. We're exposed to different forms of radiation every day, like our phones, but ionizing radiation at the center of a nuclear bomb has enough energy to rip electrons from atoms. But the amount of radiation you encounter is greatly affected by whether you're outside or inside, in a wooden structure or a cement structure, and so on. Exposure to 600 REM radiation has a 90% chance of creating fatal illness, while a dose of 450 REM is estimated to create a fatal dose within half of those affected. But even those who recover still suffer long term. Molecular bonds and strands of DNA are broken, and while most repair, around a quarter don't, which can result in future genetic mutations and increased probability of cancer. Then there is the fallout. When a bomb is detonated on or near the surface of the Earth, the blast creates a crater, and the material that used to be deposited in the crater is carried up into the air as vaporized dirt particles, forming the familiar mushroom cloud. These particles become radioactive and eventually condense and come back down as fallout. Depending on wind conditions, radioactive fallout can travel for hundreds of miles. And though it can fall in the form of black rain, for the most part, you can't detect fallout with your senses. Luckily, fallout radiation decays fairly quickly, and within 2 weeks, material will have declined to about 1% of its initial radiation level. But you would have to stay in a shelter until then. So what if a multi-bomb nuclear war broke out? A recent study imagined what 100 detonated warheads, the approximate size of a Hiroshima bomb, would look like if India and Pakistan went to war. These two nations have relatively small stockpiles of weapons compared to countries like the US, Russia, and China. However, this would still do huge damage. After the nuclear exchange, 5 megatons of black carbon would immediately enter the atmosphere, causing global temperatures to fall and receive 9% less rain annually. Though these changes sound small, they could be enough to trigger crop failures and famine. A separate study estimated 2 billion people would starve in the wake of a 100 A-bomb war. So what should you do? We created a video called How to Survive a Nuclear War.
Okay, that's what it would look like, sound like, this hour. In theory, we have Ben Rossin is coming in. 523-1450, we'll be right back. I have one last Kim Jong-un clip, which is Dallas pastor says Trump's God-given authority to take out Kim Jong-un. I thought you might find that interesting. Be right back. 651 Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, Death Row Radio, 10th of August. And this format flips September 1st. So go to Blog Talk Radio, Kelly O'Connell, Blog Talk Radio, Kelly O'Connell, where I broadcast from every day anyway, from the show as well.
Through cupped hands round the tin can, I pretend to hold you to my breast and find that you're waiting from the back road by the rivers of my memory, ever smiling, ever gentle on my mind.
Dallas pastor says Trump given a God-given authority to take out Kim Jong-un. Little Kim.
United States doesn't just have the authority to send troops into battle, but he has God's authority when it comes to all that's going on with North Korea. That is a message that came from a Dallas pastor who is one of the president's trusted evangelical supporters. Jason Allen live for us tonight in Dallas, where he asked Pastor Robert Jeffress about that very statement. Jason?
And the pastor told me that he knew the president would face some scrutiny from groups who believe that peace is the only right reaction to the situation with North Korea. But now, the pastor is also facing some of that same criticism from people he said are well-meaning but misguided.
As one of President Trump's early supporters, Pastor Robert Jeffers gave an Inauguration Day message that God had chosen Trump to keep the country safe. It's also God now, Jeffers says, who gives the president the go-ahead to use war if he needs to.
There are moral absolutes. There is absolute right and there's absolute wrong. Kim Jong-un is an evil person, and I believe that the government and President Trump have a God-given responsibility to protect its citizens from evil.
Jeffers first spoke out on the war issue Tuesday with a statement saying, in part, the book of Romans is very clear. God has endowed rulers full power to use whatever means necessary, including war, to stop evil. Disagreement followed on social media, where some told Jeffers to stop putting words in God's mouth. This church in North Dallas displayed a sign saying, no, Jesus is not cool with nukes. Jeffers sees that as confusion over biblical passages that say not to repay evil with evil.
That's talking about our individual relationships. But then in the next chapter, Paul talks about the role of government. Government is never told to forgive or to turn the other cheek. The Bible says government is to, quote, avenge those who practice evil.
The threat of nuclear action, he says, makes the stakes higher. He clarified he's not advocating for war, just the moral right of the president to wage it.
And I think we need to understand that diplomacy is always the best solution, but when it doesn't work, we cannot allow evil to triumph.
What do you think about that, huh? All right, here is some Gaffigan, where Americans put their stuff.
You see, I'm lucky enough to travel around this great land doing stand-up for audiences that have really good taste, and I've noticed a few things. It seems wherever I go in America, people seem to have three things in common. We love our country, we love our family, and we all have a storage unit. Supposedly we live in a throwaway culture. We replace our phones every year, throw out clothes that still fit us. Some people even have starter marriages, but we still have storage units. You can't drive down a highway in America without passing a storage unit complex. It appears everyone has a storage unit now. Even those people with attics and basements seem to have storage units. I don't know why there are so many storage units. We all can't be in between moves. Maybe it's quantity over quality. Maybe we are all expecting a call from the Smithsonian. Hey, do you have an ugly lamp that is also a football helmet? Good, because we're doing an exhibit on losers. If you could get that to D.C., ask a smart person where it is. I don't understand the logic of a storage unit. Hey, you know that ugly stuff we never use? Why don't we pay a stranger to hold on to it? That way we can cringe every month when we realize this stuff isn't worth the monthly charge we're paying. I think people should stop wasting money on storage units and buy a ticket to my show. God bless America.
All right, so take you out with some Glenn Campbell. Ben Rossin coming in, 523-1450. We'll be back after a break on the hour.
It's knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk. That makes me tend to leave my sleeping bag rolled up and stashed behind your couch. And it's knowing I'm not shackled by forgotten words and bonds and the ink stains that are dried upon some line.
Hey, hold
that
on
keeps you in the back row by the rivers of my memory. It keeps you ever gentle on my mind.
Who is this?
Hey, Kelly, this is Ben Rossin.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, I sent you a text. I wasn't going to be able to make it this morning, but I'm guessing you didn't get it by that last announcement, and I just wanted to call not show up on you.
I put on a shirt and it was dirty and I put my phone in the pocket. And so when I switched shirts, I forgot to get my phone. So that's fine. I got like 3 more hours of stuff to do.
Cool. I'm sorry
about that. No problem.
Thank you.
Yeah. Have a good day. Hey, it's Kelly.
Hey, Kelly, with the last couple weeks going down here, I was hoping to reignite a discussion we had locally about red light cameras.
Let's do it.
I'd love to see those red light cameras back. Maybe mention it to Ben. Of course, he's a county commissioner. He wouldn't have much to do with that, I guess. But we got to have those red light cameras back. I've only been out an hour this morning, and I've seen two people flagrantly run red lights. They never get ticketed. We got to have them back, and the city needs some money.
Hey, can you call back in 5 minutes, and we'll put it out?
Sure.
Thanks.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye. All right. So I got a phone call from Kathy, and she's going to be calling back here. She said to talk about something that may be controversial, as hard as that may be to believe. Oh, here we go. Kathy? Kathy, is that you?
Yes, it is.
Turn down that radio.
Yeah, I'll left the room.
All right.
Okay. You only got a couple weeks left. I know this is controversial. Everybody hated the red light cameras, but there is a need for the red light cameras. And I'd like to see them back. I wonder how I would go about it. I guess we'd have to petition the city commissioners.
You said you saw this morning that two people ran a red light?
Flagrantly. I mean, of course, it's early in the morning, you know, 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, and nobody's around. So, you know, I'm the only one sitting at the light, no big deal. Somebody just comes blasting through it, and I kind of figured they would, so I waited. But that's the norm in a lot of these intersections around town. The norm is somebody's going to go through it, and probably two people behind them are going to follow. And it is outrageous that it happens. It's I was driving down Picacho early one morning, heading west. I got to Motel Boulevard. The light turned red. The guy in front of me just blasted through the light. There was a sheriff's deputy sitting off to the right, waiting to go through in the other direction, heading down to the sheriff's department. He didn't do a thing. I mean, when the light changed, he continued down to the sheriff's department. I mean, the red light was run right in front of him, and he didn't do anything, which is fine. Maybe he wasn't even looking. I don't know. He's looking at his computer.
He was texting.
He was
busy texting. Maybe it was his cousin.
Might be, because, you know, I've been in town long enough to know police officers that let people off for that reason. It's called, in fact, they let other people, other deputies, family members off. It's called some kind of courtesy, professional courtesy is what it's called.
I thought it was called,
and they give it.
I thought it was called. I thought it was called Omarta.
Omarta. Okay. But let's bring them back. How do we get them back? If I remember correctly, you're really against them. You were against them because that yellow light doesn't stay yellow long enough. Well, reading up on it, that yellow light can be set for something like 2 seconds, 4 seconds, whatever. We can make an adjustment. But red light runners in this town are not getting ticketed by anybody. Of course, there's no cameras, but the police officers don't have time for that kind of traffic work. They just don't. And I'd like to see those cameras back.
All right. So we'll put it out there. If you're in favor of Kathy's loving proposal, call in. If you're not, call in 523-1450. Any other blessings for our community, Kathy?
No, that would be a good start, though. That would be a good start.
Well, wonderful. All right. Yes, let's go back. Let's go back to tyranny. All right. Thanks, Kathy.
Okay. Take care.
You
Bye.
Too. Thanks for the call. All right, folks. Red light cameras. Well, you know what they do? There's a red light in Texas. They did a study on this. One red light in Texas made $1 million a year in red light fines. And what they found out is that red light cameras don't make things safer. According to Kathy, it's off the hook, and people are just doing what they want, like after a nuclear apocalypse. But they've done studies and found that they don't make the intersections any safer because they fiddle with the yellow lights to make them shorter. So people have to skid to a halt. I wonder if one of the people that blasted through the red light today was Billy Garrett, while he was feeding his spotted owl sunflower seeds. He may not have noticed that on his shoulder. He may not have noticed that the light had turned. But anyway, I hate red light cameras. And I mean, maybe you should, I don't know, maybe you should put driving education in high school here or something. Okay, Omerta is a code of honor that places importance on silence, non-cooperation with authorities, and non-interference in the illegal actions of others. It originated and remains common in southern Italy, where banditry and the mafia-type criminal organizations like Camorra, Cosa Nostra, et cetera, are strong. Also deeply rooted in Crete. Well, you know, those Cretans never report any crimes, so... All right. Now, I don't hear any support for Kathy's idea here. And I'm just wondering, what do you want to get into today? Oh, here we have a call. Thanks for the call, the Kelly O'Connell Show. By the way, hold on a second. Ben Rossin called me and said, I heard you on the air and I'm not coming in. I texted you. And this morning I put on a shirt and put my phone in the pocket and realized that it was dirty, so I got put on a new shirt and forgot to grab my phone, so I didn't get a text. But anyway, thanks for calling in. Who's this?
Hi, it's Jer.
Jer, good morning to you. Hope you're well. And what's on your mind?
Oh, I just wanted to clear up some traffic problems here. Yellow is caution. It says it in the driver's book. Red means clear the intersection. So, you know, if you're stopped at a red light and you're still in the intersection, you have all right to blast through the red light to clear the intersection. So that's all I had.
I hear you. Thanks. All right. Thank you. All right, folks, feel free to blast through those intersections. If you happen to be caught in the middle of the intersection, ISIS is now planning on crashing drones into planes. That sounds like a low cost, like they love to do. Small investment, big payout. Looking for stories you can't live without. Oprah Winfrey coming out with her own food line. Let's see here. Russian Air Force jet flies over Pentagon, Capitol, CIA, spy jet. And China's creepy repression network is tracking humans, and Apple plays along with it. Apple disables things on their phone that could help fight against these type of things. World of elite schools and clubs beset by weird sex rituals. Huh. Eric Bolling, who was suspended by Fox for sending nasty texts, supposedly, is suing the reporter who put it out there. It seems like the fact that he was suspended would tend to verify it, but what do I know? Unexploded World War II bomb found at Fukushima nuke plant, as if they don't have enough problems. Woman sues elite dating agency after string of disastrous matches. And... well, I don't see anything that big except nuclear war and Donald Trump's been up to. All right, so I'm just wondering, you wanted to get anything into anything? I tell you what, something that happened not too far from here. Loretta Lynch, when she talked to President Clinton, that's still kind of in the news. Let's do that a little bit. Get this thing loaded here. All right, so here's the story on this one. Loretta Lynch, who was the head of the Justice Department, Attorney General at the time, met with Bill Clinton and discussed, nobody knows, but it's assumed that, you know, a lot of people assume that it had to do with Bill Clinton's wife, Hillary's, investigation into her emails. But they have found out that they did have talking points, and Loretta Lynch, being a puppet, followed those talking points like a good girl. So here, this is from ABC 15, which is in Phoenix. And this is from yesterday.
President Clinton at the Phoenix airport.
It was supposed to be a secret, though, and now new documents are coming to light tied to that meeting at Sky Harbor involving the former attorney general and former President Bill Clinton.
Yeah, ABC 15's Christopher Stein, he broke that story. Now he's uncovered even more. Chris, I have watched you pouring through documents the last couple of days. What were you able to find out?
Dan, Danielle, I've now learned that former Attorney General Loretta Lynch knew that our questions were coming, and it doesn't end there. More than 400 pages of emails and documents related to that secret meeting are now public. It reveals Lynch's staff got a tip, our tip, from a network producer which delayed Lynch's news conference at Phoenix PD that morning by nearly an hour. At the time, at least 10 high-level DOJ officials were going back and forth weighing in on how Lynch should respond to our questions about that particular meeting that was supposed to be secret. But the AG was warned and prepped for it with talking points. Now, Lynch said her and Clinton talked about golf and grandkids. So the question is, was that part of the prepared talking points? We don't know. And I'll explain why, because those portions of the talking points are all blacked out in these documents. But a staffer in the documents did write that Lynch, quote, stuck to the talking points when asked about the meeting. Dan and Danielle, the timeline of this is really interesting, and we have it all laid out right now on the front page of abc15.com.
Yeah, and you are actually mentioned in those documents as well.
Yeah, pretty interesting stuff here. It's a lengthy but interesting read.
Wow, all right. Christopher Stein, thanks so much.
All right, so that's from yesterday out of Phoenix. That meeting could have changed history because they say even James Comey, the very self-worshipping Christian of the century in his own mind, who's also a puppet of the left and carried water and stuff for the Clintons in the past and really is not who he claims to be, although he's going to make a ton of money on a book. Even he went after Lynch because he felt like he had to announce the emails because he had lost trust in the Americans, had lost trust in Loretta Lynch. And Loretta Lynch just played the role of I'm holier than you. I know more than you do. I'm better than you. I have power. You don't. I cannot be criticized. So this is from freebeacon.com. Yesterday, justice officials sent talking points to FBI and Lynch tarmac meeting with Bill Clinton. Flurry of emails between justice, FBI, and White House came just days before Comey cleared Hillary Clinton. So James Comey, I don't know about that guy. This is too long to read, but I've got a little clip from Jay Sekulow, who I'm sure will sum up all the issues here, who's become the personal lawyer for president and actually he had a law office at the school that I went to on the top floor. I never saw the guy, but because he had a number of law offices around, but here we go.
He's also from the American Center for Law and Justice, Jay Sekulow. Jay, good to see you.
Hey, Sean.
All right, let's start. Oh, did the FBI, under James Comey, being the director, did they lie when they said that they had no information when you put in a FOIA request as it relates to the tarmac meeting with Bill Clinton and then Attorney General Lynch?
So here it is. It started a year ago, and we asked for a FOIA request for information, documentation that they have regarding the meeting between President Clinton and Loretta Lynch. The response was straightforward. This is in response to your Freedom of Information Act request. By the way, it was dated October 21st, 2016. The FOIA request came in July. No records responsive to your request were located. No records were located. Then we sent the same request to the Department of Justice. And lo and behold, here it is. We get about 420 pages. And in those 420 pages are emails between guess who? The Department of Justice and the FBI. And the contents and context of those emails is an attempt to create the narrative, define the story, develop talking points. We're getting press inquiries about this. The FBI's chief of staff receives an email. By the way, the chief of staff, senior counsel to who? James Comey, receives an email from the Department of Justice saying we've got to figure out how we're going to respond to all of this. And then take it a step further, Sean. So we've got a lot of those. All of this is to produce what are called talking points, which, like you said, it's unusual that you would think you'd have talking points in a situation like this. Yeah, yeah.
Isn't the DOJ and the FBI supposed to be nonpartisan? I thought talking points were for politicians and their campaigns. I believe that the DOJ and FBI should not be using talking points. Is that pretty obvious?
Right. Right, but here's the problem. They're trying to create a narrative, and we've been talking about this for a year. Now we finally got results. By the way, we had to go to federal court against the Department of Justice almost a year ago, to get these documents. So this is litigation that's been pending a little less than a year. So we get the documents. All of this leading up to we've got reports in there. And you mentioned this in your monologue, where a Washington Post reporter saying, "Hey, I need clarification on this. Trying to fix this." New York Times reporter saying, "I'm being pressed into duty here. I think I could ask you a few questions and put this to rest," is what the Washington Post reports.
So
all this is going on.
The same
of course.
People exposed who have been working with the Clinton campaign and feeding questions, colluding during the campaign.
Yeah, well, even a step further here, the Washington Post reporter states that she modified a paragraph of the report based on additional information that the reporter was provided. And the reporter then states, "Well, next time I'll know to go directly to you for this rather than to this other person that the reporter went to." But here's the point, Sean. Guess what is not included in the Freedom of Information Act request? The talking points. They redacted those. Here are the talking points. This is what we got. So let me tell you what we're doing Monday. Back to federal court we go, demanding the talking points, which they acknowledge exist, that they created. But again, this shows you exactly what was all of the concerns we had. Yep.
All right, so there's that, and we'll take a little break here and be right back. A refreshing story, possibly refreshing, who knows. Joe Manchin, former governor of West Virginia, now senator, one of the most conservative senators in the Democratic Party. Maybe the only one, who knows. He says he won't vote with his party and he doesn't give an SH, you know what, if it costs him an election. And so they're pressuring him because of the fact that his own governor switched parties and West Virginia is turning into a Republican stalwart because the old Democratic Party is gone and will not be coming back. All right, here's a little bit on Rod Rosenstein. I think Rod Rosenstein, who's running the Russia investigation, he's over Mueller, the special counsel. Rod Rosenstein is part of the deep state, just my opinion. Here's a little bit from Rush.
Tonight, CNN website. You know, CNN on their website, they publish occasionally some sensible stuff. And I think on their website is where they, if they care to, they claim balance. For example, they've got a piece by Matthew Whitaker, who is a CNN legal commentator, it says. Now, he may be on CNN. I don't watch enough of it to know if he's an on-air commentator. It says here he is. The only time CNN's on is during the program here. And it's just on in case there's breaking news or something odd that I just happen to see after glancing at it. Anyway, this piece is all about, could have written it. It could have come from this show. Mueller's investigation of Trump is going too far. CNN. Now, the guy's a former federal prosecutor, which means he knows the Justice Department regulations, particularly on prosecution. And he knows full well that Mueller is out of bounds here. He knows that Mueller really shouldn't have been appointed because there's no underlying crime. But his whole piece, Mueller's investigation of Trump is going too far, is about the fact that there are no boundaries containing Mueller as there should be. And the boundaries are Russia over here and Russia over there. This investigation should be about collusion or obstruction vis-a-vis the charge.
So kind of running out of time, but I want to get into the fact that it's a good clip by Rush, but it's very long. What Mueller is doing is unprecedented, but it's also all of these people are throwing them. It's like watching, you know, they have these festivals in India where they throw themselves in front of these. I'm trying to remember that what they call them. There's a specific name that got translated into the West. I'll think of it. But throwing themselves in front of stuff at a parade to get smashed. They're sacrificing themselves for the anti-Trump campaign, because if you're on the left, truly on the left, that's all you have is politics. And it's a great honor to sacrifice yourself for the cause, even if it totally destroys your reputation. Here's from CNN.
Believe that story.
The Russia investigation continues to widen as federal investigators explore the potential financial ties of President Trump and associates to Russia. Sources tell CNN financial links could offer a more concrete path to any potential prosecution. For the president, that's going too far. He's warned that delving into his businesses is a, quote, violation. Trump has maintained there's no collusion and he has no financial ties to Russia.
And I can tell you, speaking for myself, I own nothing in Russia. I have no loans in Russia. I don't have any deals in Russia.
Now, 1 year into this complex probe, the FBI has reviewed financial records related to the Trump Organization, the president himself, as well as his family members and campaign associates. CNN.
All right, so you know all of this right now, but this guy, this Matthew Whitaker, writes this article, and it's pretty good. You can access it. Just put in Matthew Whitaker and Trump, his name. Now, here's a little bit on Paul Manafort's home getting raided. Paul Manafort is by far the most likely guy to get picked up in any sting, because Manafort has been involved with the Ukraine for a long time. But the reason that Manafort was picked for the campaign wasn't for Russia. It was for the fact that he was an expert at getting delegates. But here we go. CBS, a brief clip on this raid.
Details this morning surrounding the FBI raid of one of Paul Manafort's homes. Agents raided President Trump's former campaign chairman's home 2 weeks ago. They were reportedly looking for evidence related to the special counsel's investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. Manafort's spokesman said he has consistently cooperated with law enforcement and other serious inquiries, and did so on this occasion as well. Juliana Goldman is outside FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. Juliana, good morning.
Good morning. Well, it's a very aggressive move and another indication that Mueller's investigation is heating up. As you mentioned, Manafort's team says that he's been cooperating, but this raid of his home indicates otherwise. Formal prosecutors tell us that typically in white-collar crime investigations, lawyers negotiate a handing over of evidence, but the fact that they executed a search warrant means that they felt they needed the element of surprise. They didn't trust Manafort not to destroy materials that could be relevant to the investigation. Now, something else to consider, sources have told us that the special counsel is investigating Manafort's business dealings. And again, typically in criminal investigations, prosecutors, well, they'll try to flip witnesses up the chain of command, and that could be what Mueller is trying to do here, to squeeze Manafort, to pressure him to give up information on others in the campaign. Charlie, the special counsel's office declined to comment.
All right. So let's check out some local news now. Here's a song by Glenn Campbell, "The Moon's a Harsh Mistress" by Jimmy Webb, the guy that wrote Galveston and Wichita Lineman, all those songs. And by the time I get to Phoenix, and it's about a story written by Robert Heinlein about a moon colony that goes native. And it's basically the story of America put on the moon. This colony demands their own rights. It's a great story. 732, 733, Kelly O'Connell will be right back. 523-1450 to call in. Live. Always live. Glenn Campbell, one of the greatest live performers in history.
Careful if you try, though she looks as warm as gold. Moon's a hearts. Moon can be so cold.
Here is a weird story, and I'm still kind of reading it in the middle. A postmortem solved strange case of French pair who died at dinner. And these guys were in a French village called Autun du Perche, which I don't know what part of the country it's in, but they were at dinner, and Oliver Boudon, 38, was found lying on his back on the ground, and Lucien Perrault, 69, sitting at the terrace before a half-finished plate of camembert cheese, a partly eaten baguette or bread, and a glass of wine. Neither one of them showed signs of an attack or a fight. A neighbor saw them and thought they were drunk. They came in and tested the beans that they were eating to see if they had botulism. And there was no botulism in the beans. Now, they did a post-mortem on the older man, and he had 2.4 G/L. Well, he had a lot of, I don't know exactly what that translates to, but he had a lot of alcohol in his blood, and he had choked after trying to swallow a 1.5-ounce piece of beef rib without chewing it properly since he was missing several teeth. Doctors say the younger man probably had a heart attack seeing his friend die because he had a genetic or he had a pre-existing heart condition. Pretty weird, though. And all right, so I wanted to get into this story about Google. I found a clip of this guy who had said that basically there's this giant uproar out there over Google's culture. And Google is Google is far left. So what they do is put together seminars and try to teach people how to be leftists, you know, how to think about gender and all this business. So this guy writes this article and says it's for Google. He writes it and passes it around. This culture in Google is a problem. And so, that there's a reason that there's not as many women in the tech, in the engineering part, is that women are not naturally gifted in these areas. It caused a huge uproar. And this guy was at Harvard, and obviously a smart character. But I thought it was kind of an interesting thing to talk about. What's the one of the big deals in America today, which is talking about gender. And there's this message that's put out by the left, the very contradictory message is we have to protect women and minorities and fill in the blank, trannies, whatever you want to stick in there. These people have to be protected because historically they've been mistreated. And at the same time, it's treating these things like gender as being totally superficial. If you make up your mind one day that you're not a man, you're a woman, you have the right to be start being called a woman and treated as a woman, use the woman's bathroom. Being a woman is just a state of mind. It's just an idea that you get in your mind. So there's nothing deep. So if there's nothing deep about being a woman, why defend it? You know, I mean, so anyway. That's just my take, but here's a little bit from this story. This guy got canned for putting out a controversial memo, and what they should have done, in my opinion, make him the ombudsman. This guy obviously can think outside of the box. Put him in a position where he can use his ability to think against the grain to help foster discussion, but instead of course, they just fired him. Here's a little bit.
Controversy sparked by a former Google engineer who wrote a 10-page memo criticizing the company's diversity program, saying women lag behind in the tech world because of their biology. Tonight he's out of a job, but he's standing by his words as we hear from him for the first time Here's ABC's chief business correspondent, Rebecca Jarvis.
Tonight, the fired software engineer who sparked a firestorm after challenging Google's diversity program speaking out.
I'm not saying that any of the female engineers at Google are in any way worse than the average male engineer.
In an interview on YouTube, James Damore standing by his internal memo in which he argues that women on average have more neuroticism and higher anxiety, lower stress tolerance than men, and that the abilities of men and women differ in part due to biological causes, and that these differences may explain why we don't see equal representation of women in tech and leadership. Damore says he values diversity, but insists that by recognizing differences, we can improve the workplace.
For example, cooperativeness, which is higher in women than men. We should make the workplace a place where you can actually thrive if you're cooperative.
Google firing Damore after his post went viral, saying his words violated their code of conduct by advancing harmful gender stereotypes in our workplace. Today, the CEO of YouTube, owned by Google's parent company, sharing how hard it was to explain the memo to her daughter. I thought about how tragic it was that this unfounded bias was now being exposed to a new generation.
David, the Labor Department is already investigating allegations of wage discrimination. Google denies those allegations.
So anyway, is it true, like the leader of YouTube, that it's unfounded that there are differences between men and women? Is that unfounded? Is that what she should be teaching her child? We'll take a break and come back and talk about this a little bit more. 523-1450. Is the left accepting the world as it is and trying to make the best out of it, or is it trying to remake the world in its own image and failing spectacularly? 523-1450. We'll be back here some weather.
Once the sun did shine, good Lord, it felt so fine. The moon of phantom gold through the mountains and the pines.
All right, here's a little bit more in this interview. Here's an interview with this guy, James Damore, who claims that men and women are different, that men are more gifted in engineering and that type of thing and leadership, and therefore there's not as many women as who are involved. From Bloomberg Technology from yesterday.
Been fired. What's your reaction to that, and how are you feeling right now?
I'm definitely hurt. I love Google, and I've always been a fan of Google even before I joined. And so it really feels like they betrayed me in some way.
Why do you feel betrayed?
Because the whole point of my memo was actually to improve Google and Google's culture. And they just punished me and shamed me for doing it.
Has any of the feedback that you've gotten changed your position at all?
So I actually published it about a month ago, and throughout that period, I continuously updated it and did take in a lot of feedback. And so what the document now is what I largely believe is the scientific consensus for a lot of these issues. And so I have taken in a lot of feedback.
So you put this up a month ago. Did any executives come to talk to you? I'm just curious if there was any, you know, follow-up within the organization at the highest levels.
No, so I shared it with many of our diversity programs, and with individual Googlers, but no one high up ever came to me and said, no, don't do this. Even though there were many people that looked at it. It was only after it got viral that the upper management started shaming me and eventually firing me.
Do you regret anything that you did in this whole process?
It's hard to regret it just because I do believe that I'm trying to make Google and the world in general a better place by not confining us to our ideological echo chambers where only one side of the story can be heard and it's totally intolerant to other viewpoints and even scientific evidence.
What scientific evidence are you talking about? Because in the follow-up to your piece, there have been plenty of discussion about this and discussion about the fact that there is no research to support this idea that there are biological causes for the lack of women in tech or the lack of women in leadership positions. I spoke to Megan Smith, who worked at Google, who was the, you know, former CTO for the United States, and she said that this is a myth.
Among psychologists, there's a consensus that prenatal testosterone does affect a lot of personality traits, and in particular, one's interest in people versus things.
You see how these people on the far left will lie. This girl, I don't know anything about her background, obviously, but what she's saying is just an absolute lie. There are biological differences between men and women. The most obvious one is women have babies and men don't. And there's a huge difference related to that. But from conception, from the time that testosterone is introduced into the womb for male babies, there develops huge differences. How can this reporter be so ignorant of this?
And I'm not saying that all men are different than all women, just that there's a distribution of these personality traits, and that distribution differs between men and women. And so there are very many capable women at Google, and I'm not trying to say that any of them are any worse than average male engineer at Google. Just I was trying to address why we don't have equal representation from the population. And it's largely because of the differing interest in people versus things, which is linked to prenatal testosterone.
Susan Wojcicki wrote a very impassioned response to this. And she said that your memo, had it been about Black people or Latinos or the LGBT community, that you wouldn't have anyone defending you. How do you respond to that?
So I think that that's just a false analogy, and she's trying to lump me in with racists and other bigots, which I'm not. I'm not a sexist, and I'm not a racist. So I think that that's just trying to smear my image rather than actually looking at the evidence. Very little of the responses have been actually looking at the science. They've just been calling me names or nitpicks of, oh, the formatting was a little wrong, or the original leaked document that someone else leaked didn't have any citations when my original document did.
James, the alt-right has turned you into a hero. How do you feel about that? I mean, do you identify with that group?
So I don't really identify with alt-right. I'm more of a centrist, and I don't think that we should have such a strong ideology that really divides different people. I think that there's a lot more that we can do to try to bring people together. And so I'm very sympathetic to maybe some of the same struggles that especially some of the conservative people at Google face.
Can you give us any specifics about hiring and diversity practices that you felt were wrong or felt were illegal?
So there were several hiring practices that treated people differently based on what their race and gender are. And
how so?
So, for example, making it easier for someone to get into Google based on what their race or gender is.
How would Google make it easier for those people to get in the door? What hiring practices did you see that would make it easier for a woman or an underrepresented minority to get through the door?
Yeah, so there are several things. They can be given a different number of interviews. So for example, say I get a bad interview, then I'm just forgotten by Google. But then they can actually give certain people multiple interviews in case the first one was bad.
All right, so there's, I don't know, two more minutes on this. but you get the story there. This lady, Emily Chang, is interviewing him, and she's got went to Harvard, but she did social studies. So I don't understand how you're not how is it that if you're on the left, you act like you've never been exposed to any ideas other than the ones that you believe in? I don't get that. Seriously. I mean, isn't it the mark of an educated person that you know both sides of arguments and stories and theories? You know, so many of these people who come out of the Ivy League, they sound like robots. They sound like people that have never had an original thought in their brain. Here is Happy National French Friday, Jim Gaffigan.
We lie to ourselves when we eat McDonald's fries. We're like, oh, they're so thin, they couldn't be fattening. You ever eat too many McDonald's fries? Of course not! There's never enough of them. There's always that moment when you're eating McDonald's fries where you're like, what happened? Where'd they go? Then you start scrounging for the fry crumbs. You're like, No, that's just a piece of paper from the straw. But it was touching the fries, so. Sometimes there's a loose fry in the bag. You know, the bonus fry? It's like Jesus is up in heaven. Give him an extra fry. He'll pay it forward.
I think I played that one before. But in any event, so the differences between men and women in your experience. In your experience, are there differences between men and women? Are they just superficial? Are they just made up by the society? Are they deeply rooted? This is the argument here, and it goes to the root of the worldview, of the beliefs, of the convictions of leftists, socialists, Marxists, progressives, whatever you want to call them, believe that there is no such thing as human nature. Anyone can be trained to do anything. And that if you want a sex change, it's like Mr. Potato Head. Just go over to the doctor and get, you know, pull your parts off and get different parts, and all of a sudden you're a different gender. And it's totally irrational. It's totally contradictory to the other things that we fight for. Why would there be a national organization of women? Why is there feminism? Why is there, why would there be lesbian separatism if these women didn't experience their lives as totally different than men? You know, I just don't get it. Anyway, leftism bound to fail. It was born in failure. It lives in failure. It will die in failure. 7:59, you can quote me on that. Take you out with some Glenn Campbell, a beautiful, beautiful song named The Moon's a Harsh Mistress by Jimmy Webb. Have a great day. We'll meet you back in 22 hours. We'll get into this topic more tomorrow. Have a great day. Ciao.
And then the darkness fell. Hard to love her well.